This episode of the Vision Board Podcast is brought to you by Onnit. Why Onnit, you ask? Well, here's a word from Onnit's founder and CEO, Aubrey Marcus.
You know, Onnit is the company that has the tools to improve your performance. And in whatever area that you're looking for, we have something to do it. You know, it's like going to it's the Home Depot of house repair, but instead of house repair, it's body and mind repair. You know, and it's body and mind performance enhancement. It's going to that body shop and figuring out what tools that you can apply to help make your life better.
At the Vision Board Podcast, we only promote supplements that we use ourselves, and we only use the best. To give you insights, here's Johnny.
Yeah, guys, my two favorite that I take, one, Alpha Brain. Alpha Brain really helps improve mental focus and memory, and the second one I really swear by is Shroom Tech. Shroom Tech is designed to help your body with energy and cardiovascular endurance. What's your favorite, Tristan?
Johnny, the two that I love is the Warrior Buffalo Bars. I find these delicious snacks, and they're also perfect for when I'm on the road and also on the run. Also, I love the Dolce Whey. They're grass-fed whey protein isolate, perfect for my smoothies and also my post-workout shakes. Now, guys, check out the range at www.onnit.com, and please use code word VISIONBOARD for 10% off at checkout. Now, guys, enjoy the show.
Ladies and gentlemen, today is the first day of the rest of your life. And now, listen in as Tristan and Johnny bring it all to the table on the Vision Board Podcast.
Guys, welcome back. Episode 135 of the Vision Board Podcast. I'm Tristan Cannell. Alongside me, Johnny Stuffgold.
What's up, TK? What's up, everybody? 135, who we got?
We got Jordan Harbinger in the house.
The Art of Charm, Nonverbal Communication.
Man. Yeah, man, it's going to be an interesting episode. The fact that, you know, he is a very established broadcaster / podcaster himself. It's going to be interesting to see how we able to interview the man that interviews everyone else.
So. Yeah, it's that experience too, man. You get to a certain stage, if your passions are aligned with your strengths, that experience you can't buy, and then it just resonates through you. Jordan's a perfect example of that.
Yeah, for sure. So, guys, just before we get Jordan on, big thank you to everyone tuning into the show. Really, really appreciate all the emails and texts and all the messages we get on pretty much a weekly basis now, which is great. Please continue to share it with your family and friends and leave us a 5-star review on iTunes.
We appreciate you guys. Anyone listening at home new to this, we appreciate you. Guys have been hanging on the Vision Board since we started. We appreciate you. Stay tuned, man. We're just getting started.
Yeah, we've got some big shows coming up. But let's concentrate in the now, and let's get Jordan Harbinger on the show. Our special guest is Jordan Harbinger. Jordan's an entrepreneur, talk show host, and world-renowned social dynamics expert. He is the co-founder of the hit show, The Art of Charm, which is a leading self-development program interviewing world-leading entrepreneurs, celebrities, writers, and experts about psychology, performance, life, and success. We welcome Jordan Harbinger. Jordan, welcome to the Vision Board Podcast, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, guys. It's funny because when I got the invite from Vision Board, I was like, oh, God, I don't know. I don't like Vision Boards that much, so I don't know how this is going to work. But you guys seem cool, so here we are.
Thanks, Jordan, for accepting the invitation and stopping by. I want to start this thing off with, you know, in the beginning, before The Art of Charm, you were, you know, in the law realm, University of Michigan. What drew you into starting a podcast and wanting to interview people?
Yeah, so I started by getting my internship on Wall Street, and initially, the problem was when you grow up and you're kind of maybe, and I'm not saying I'm some kind of kid whiz or anything like that, whiz kid, but I was always decent at school. I could kind of fake my way through it. And that worked all the way up until college. And then in college, everyone is equally or more smart than you are, and you can no longer do that. Except in the States anyway, everybody's getting wasted all the time. It's their first time away from home. They're totally out of control. They can't keep it together. So you can outwork everyone. So I shifted from cruise through everything without really trying to outwork everyone. And that worked well in law school as well. However, when I got to Wall Street, it was a bunch of hard workers who also had talent and were smart. And I thought, oh, crap, there goes my competitive advantage. And the guy who hired me, his name was Dave. And Dave was never in the office, which is weird. Because if you're a lawyer, you're supposed to be in the office billing in 6-minute increments. That's basically how you make money as an attorney. So it just didn't make any sense to me that this guy was never there. And he was supposed to be mentoring me, and all the other summer associates, they were going on cool trips and going to see Blue Man Group and eating, you know, steak lunches and having drinks on the rooftop. And I was just so neglected. And so HR made Dave take me out for coffee one day. And he said, ask me anything you want. And I'm sure he thought I was going to ask about real estate derivatives or whatever. And I said, how come you're never in the office, but you're a partner and you're, you know, one of the top guys? I don't understand. Do you just work from home all the time? And he was kind of incredulous because you don't ask those types of questions to your boss generally, especially not to your boss's 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 boss or whatever. And he put down his BlackBerry and he's like, look, actually, I don't worry about what I bill because I bring in deals. And so I don't worry about hitting my billable hours bonus. I don't worry about adding value because I'm bringing in clients. And I thought, well, all right, how do you do that? And he said, oh, well, you know, I go do jiu-jitsu with these guys, and I always go boating with these other guys, and I play golf with these guys, and I go to charity events with this other group. And I thought, so you're more valuable outside the office than you are inside the office. And he kind of nodded his head, and I did the math on this, and I realized that if you sit there and you bill thousands of hours a year, and you have a team and they're billing thousands of hours a year, you can bill millions of dollars in legal work, you know, this group of people. However, Dave was able to bring in millions of dollars in legal work for a diminishing amount of hours, because once you spend 40 hours or 100 hours or whatever becoming someone's friend, every time you hang out with them, you know, you have the chance of getting another deal. You don't have to rebuild all that trust and rapport. It's already there. So his marginal value of time, his return on the value of time, was constantly increasing, whereas everybody who's billing per hour was basically staying the same or decreasing or just going along with the market. And that was a huge game changer for me, because not only was Dave worth more than $1,000 an hour, he was worth whatever the deal was that he brought in divided by the number of hours it took to get him there, right? So he could have been worth 10 grand an hour, depending on the size of the deal. Not only that was that the case, but he also seemed to have a lot more flexibility and a lot more control. And that to me was an enormous advantage. And last but not least, this was a sort of hidden third path that I had not thought about in the past, right? I thought, oh, you got to be smarter than everybody. You got to be harder working than everybody. And that's really hard to do when everyone's working 20 hours a day and is already smarter than you. So this was a thing that nobody was paying attention to, an advantage that nobody had even begun to think about yet, at least not in the first few years of being an associate. And I knew it would be everyone's weak point by the time they woke up and realized they needed it in like 5 years. So I thought, if I learn and master this, the social element, the rapport and networking skill sets, the soft skills, then this will be my advantage, my competitive advantage, probably forever. Because by the time other people realize that it's needed, I'll have 5 years on them of really having my foot on the gas. So I started talking about these concepts, nonverbal communication, verbal communication, body language, eye contact, rapport, trust, and networking. And I started to get obsessed with it. And I started to talk about it with friends and read books about it and teach other people what I knew so that I could solidify my own knowledge. Because somewhere I'd read, you know, if you really know something, you can teach it or something like that. And so that was 10 years ago. And me and my now business partner, AJ, who we were having these conversations together, he was working in a cancer lab at the time. We decided that so many people everywhere we went were interested in this. And everyone was saying, write a book, write a book, write a book. And, you know, I was studying for the bar exam in New York. AJ was getting a PhD in molecular cellular biology. Nobody was going to write a book. So we started a podcast. It was brand new at that point, 2006, literally just a new thing. And we started talking about what we were reading with each other and with experts and with the authors. And that's how the show started. And that's where we are today. Only now I'm talking to Shaquille O'Neal and the world's most famous neuroscientists instead of some guy who wrote a PDF on the internet.
Yeah, Jordan, pre-Dave, before meeting Dave, how good were you with relationships?
Terrible. I was super shy, quiet, introverted. People would always ask me for advice, but never on the topic of soft skills or people skills, generally. I was always really quiet, really shy. I was afraid to be mocked or anything. You know, I just had, when I was in middle school, I just basically skipped school all the time. I got obsessed with the internet. High school, I was really quiet. even though I started to become more outgoing. And then in college, I just went right back into my shell again. Study, study, study. Pretend that, oh, I'm focused on my schoolwork. That's why I'm not going to the parties, you know, stuff like that. And in part, it was because I was a geek, but I wasn't just a geek. I was also just highly introverted and shy. And so I really realized that I knew that when I met Dave, I was like, I have a choice right now. I can either say I'm screwed because I'm not a social person and I'm never going to get that skill set, or I can throw myself into it and just trust that I will eventually be able to pick up on this. And I think there was a part of me that said, look, Jordan, you need to learn this stuff anyways. You might as well learn it now because you're not going to get smarter and you're not going to be able to work more than 20 hours a day for the next 30 years anyways. So this is your choice. You either suck it up and just get this done and realize that this is an area of growth, or you keep burying your head in the sand and eventually you get punished and fired and end up living on your mom's couch.
Jordan, having been in the game, the podcast realm, new media for 10 years, like you mentioned, could you share with us a little bit about things that have remained the same or things that have changed in terms of you getting ready to interview people, the mindset and preparation and things like that?
Sure. I mean, it's strange to even think about it, because in the beginning of the show, we weren't interviewing people, we were prepping, and we outlined everything we wanted to say on the show as bullet points and this and that and the other thing, and there was always a bunch of different ideas that we had to write down and get across. And then after the first few episodes, me and AJ were like, oh, look, we're not going to outline this, we should just talk. And that was great because it seemed more natural, but we did lose some of the structure. And then over the years, there's been this sort of back and forth battle between how much do I prepare, how much do I script, how much do I run this? And now it's sort of a more advanced version of that where I do a lot of prep, a ton of it, and then I take some notes and then I take the conversation freely from there based on the notes that I took from the person's book, their movies, their videos, any talks that they've given, anything like that. So it's better to over-prepare, and then you have to figure out how to get away from the prep so that it doesn't become a prison that constrains your work as an interviewer.
Yeah, definitely. Talk a little bit about interviewing Shaq, because I listened to it the other day. It was brilliant, man. But, you know, for me, if I was interviewing Shaq, you know, today I'd be nervous as hell. Tell us about the process for you.
Sure. I mean, that took a couple of years to be able to get Shaq on board. But once he did, I mean, we have mutual friends, so it wasn't impossible. It was just, it just took a long time because of his schedule, yeah, as you might imagine. But yeah, I mean, I was a little nervous just because of the tech situation. I'm never really nervous that the conversation's not going to go well. I get nervous because of hiccups that happen with the tech. And so with this particular show, they told me, I think like the day before, that, oh, we're going to film the whole thing using a special virtual reality camera so that people can follow along at home who are fans of our network, Podcast One, and they can watch it like they're in the room with you. And I was like, that's fine. I don't care about being filmed. That wasn't what made me nervous. But what made me nervous is when I came in, I have my own tech. I always use my own microphones. I use my own recorder. I know that it's going to be safe. I can keep an eye on it. And they were like, yeah, you can't use that because you need to be able to route the audio to the VR camera. So we're going to use our own tech. And I don't trust other people who aren't running the show. I only trust my producer and myself. And they've made mistakes before at this particular studio, like leaving a mic on in the production booth so that when they're chit-chatting about what they're going to have for dinner, it's recording over my track or recording over my guest's track, and I can't get rid of it. And so I just basically had to kind of get a little bit zen with it and be like, okay, this is going to happen. And I had a backup in place, but that's what made me nervous because I was waiting for somebody there to make a stupid mistake and mess up 2 years of work. But luckily that didn't happen. So, but I don't get nervous about my own abilities in hosting a show anymore because I've done so many.
Jordan, we talk a lot about on the show, the importance of being vulnerable, getting out of our comfort zones, taking risks. And Tristan and I, to share a story, you know, in the first year and a half, 2 years, there's been moments where we've had interviews. Maybe we weren't necessarily experienced enough to do them, but we both knew and understood we needed to do that to grow. You know, along your journey and where you are today, could you maybe share one of those stories with us that, you know, maybe a huge interview presented itself and you had to say yes because you knew you had to grow, but maybe you weren't quite ready for it?
I don't know. I think I'm pretty much ready for anything now. I think I spent more time not going for big stuff and big names and big game because I thought, oh, it eventually happened, or, oh, yeah, maybe I'm not ready for that. But then once it did, it was just kind of like, all right, I'm good. I can't think of anybody right now that would come into the studio here and I'd be like, oh, man, I'm not going to be able to handle this. The hardest interviews are not Barack Obama or whatever. The hardest interviews are people who are used to controlling their own show. So the hardest interview for me is not going to be the hardest interview for me is not going to be Arnold Schwarzenegger. The hardest interview for me would be like Howard Stern.
Yeah.
Because he is not used to being an interviewee. And you can even see him go and talk with like Larry King, another person who's done 60,000 interviews or something like that.
Yeah, actually. And it's funny you say that because your Larry King interview was different to all your other interviews. And it's probably because he was trying to control you, right?
I mean, that's the thing that you find with experienced hosts is we can't not control the situation. Like right now, and there's nothing wrong with this, I'm definitely controlling the flow of this particular show. I'm not saying that to you guys in any way. It's a force of habit that I can't switch off. And
for sure.
The same thing goes for Larry King and Howard Stern and all these other hosts. It's really hard to sit there and be a guest and not be a lame ass piece of wood, you know?
That's true. When was that moment when you changed it from just being a hobby, Jordan, to actually wanted to make a business out of it?
So it happened a lot quicker than I thought, and it was a total accident. What happened was we started doing the show, and people started to basically write in and say, hey, I want you guys to coach me. And I was like, I'm not really a coach. Me and AJ both sat there like, look, we're not coaches. We're not life coaches or you know, dating coaches or body language coaches or whatever these people were asking for. We're just not. It's not our shtick. And this is 10, 12 years ago now, especially. And the people were like, no, you don't understand. I've already hired therapists and day planners and business coaches and body language coaches and stylists. They're not giving me the useful information that I'm getting for free from your podcast. So I know that you can coach me just from talking to me on the phone. And it was like, well, all right, $50 an hour. And, you know, we started doing that. And then we immediately talked about that on the show. And then our calendar filled up. And I said, $100 an hour. And then we had a couple other people calling and saying, look, here's $5,000. I just want you on retainer. And I'm like, all right. And then he said, by the way, raise your prices. $100 an hour? Come on. My lawyer charges five times that much. And I thought, oh, okay. So we'll just go up in price. And we started doing that. And some of our phone coaching clients were like, hey, look, I need to learn this directly from you. The phone calls are great, but I really want to see it. I want to see what you're doing. I want to model what you're doing and apply it. How do I do that? And I said, well, we don't offer that. Look, I'm an attorney. I work on Wall Street at this point. I live in New York. I work all day. I can't have you come and do this. And a lot of our students who wanted this were saying things like, look, I'll give you $5,000 if I can hang out with you for a week. And so I spent one of my vacations hanging out with a guy for $5,000. And it was awesome because I was just working on other stuff and hanging out and going out with a buddy of mine. And I got paid. And I talked about that on the show. And then people just came out of the woodwork like, oh, my God, that's an option. I want to do that. And I thought, oh, I don't have enough vacation time. So me and AJ, we started hiring people to coach for us at the Art of Charm. And that was the initial synthesis of the company, because when these coaches they're great. There's one that's still here, Johnny. When he got here, he was like, great, where's the curriculum? And we were like, and he's like, yeah, got it. I'll make a curriculum. So he came in, we created all this curriculum, and it's been evolving for the past decade. And now, of course, we have full-time coaches, and I'm no longer an attorney, or at least not a practicing attorney. So it was an interesting kind of situation because we never intended for this to be a business. It was never designed that way. It was designed to be stream of consciousness, things that were helping me and AJ navigate networking, relationship development, and things like that. And what ended up happening was there was just nobody serving this audience well. The only things that we had that were competitors were like these weird pickup artist guys that were just like super creepy and bizarre. And then on the other side of the coin, there were like Dale Carnegie classes where the depth of their advice is look people in the eye when you shake hands and make sure you have a firm handshake. And I remember thinking to myself, look, if people don't like you and they're not hiring you and they're not promoting you or women aren't dating you or you don't have enough friends, it's not because you don't have a firm fucking handshake. There's something else going on. And nobody was talking about what those things were, in part because they didn't see them, and also in part because people don't want to bring up something that they can't handle or fix. And so we just thought there's no point in having a firm handshake if you've got everything, if everything else is chaos. And so we started focusing on the root causes, and that was very useful for the people that were listening.
You just mentioned, speaking of useful, some very important notes, key points for Tristan and I and anybody else listening at home who are thinking about redistributing content or other ideas to deliver your already known product. And that's one of my favorite things about interviewing people on the show, Jordan, guys like yourself, is we get to learn. We get to learn different insights and ideas. Could you share maybe with us recently something that you've picked up maybe from one of your recent guests that kind of hits you and you're like, oh, wow, I've never thought about it that way?
I'm trying to think somebody who's hit me with something that I've never thought about before. And I mean, there's tons, but usually I think about it in preparation when reading their book. So it's like, oh yeah, that. So I'm trying to think of a time on the show when I've said, what, wait, really? And I'm not sure that there is anything. And part of this is due to the fact that I probably over-prepare for each of these interviews, but I think one of the counterintuitive bits that we've had recently was Mike Rowe from the TV show Dirty Jobs.
Yeah.
He came on recently and he was very adamant that the advice to follow your passion was complete BS. And I agree with that. The reason being that most people follow their passion straight onto their mother's couch. And the reason we hear from big shots and successful people that say, follow your passion, is because there's a selection bias. If you are a billionaire because you followed your passion, people are going to listen to you and you have a microphone and a platform. If for the 1,000 other people or the 1,000,000 other people statistically that then followed their passion straight into their parents' basement, those people don't have a microphone. So we tend to think of things like follow your passion as good advice. And Mike gave pretty concrete examples about why that just wasn't true. And a lot of these bits of advice, like follow your passion, are really counterproductive because you see a lot of people, especially millennials, doing things like, well, I'm not making any money and I'm not learning any useful skills, but I'm doing what I'm passionate about and that's all that matters. And that's frankly just a bunch of BS. If you're not able to support yourself, you're not able to get any higher purpose because of this, if you're not able to create a life for yourself and for your family, it doesn't really matter that you're trying to force the square peg through the round hole and doing what you enjoy. You're just doing a hobby full time at that point. And that's really counterproductive because a lot of people have to learn that lesson the hard way and they really shouldn't. But the reason that they're forcing it is because they think that successful people follow their passion, which is by and large not true.
Do you feel, though, it could be an issue of in reference to the ones who are back to the couch, not really being real with themselves in terms of their strengths, what they're good at, their skill sets, and correlating a passion with like a delusional vision?
Yeah, I think there's definitely some of that. I think there's a lot of people that thing, and it's not just being aware of your strengths. Sure, there's a lot of people who, I mean, we've all seen the auditions for America's Got Talent or The Voice, and they come in and it's like, she bang, you know, that guy, like,
yeah,
that guy,
yeah,
has a delusional sense, yeah, of what he's able to accomplish.
William Ho.
Yeah, for the wrong reason, right?
Yeah, right.
But yeah, I mean, there's people who are delusional about their abilities, but that's okay. I mean, you can work on things that you're not good at as long as you have an accurate representation of how good you are at any given time. It's fine. But I also think that there's not just a delusion about what you're good at, but also a feeling that people are starting to adopt that they have to do something that they're really passionate about. So, Oh, you grew up liking skateboarding? Don't get a job. You're going to do something where you get paid to skateboard. And that's just a bunch of malarkey. There's a few spots in skateboarding, along with every other profession, where you're paid to do something that most people have as a hobby. Having a talk show, for example, is one of those things. We were able to create a large revenue business because we were working on this for 10 years, you know, and we didn't start making a lot of money doing this for the first few years that we did. Most people are not willing to put in that work. And frankly, there was a large element of luck. You know, the timing that we had when starting a show 1 year after podcasting became popular, the fact that there may be an element of natural talent, it's hard to measure that. But going back to when I was a kid, I always had a loud voice. I was always opinionated. I was always a good critical thinker. I got taught critical thinking in law school even more. And, you know, I was a good reader. reader, good student at that point because I'd forced myself to learn those habits. There's a lot of things that come into play here that aren't just the same as an early mover advantage, which is also a bit of luck. So there's just, but there's people that say, I love talking to people. I should have a podcast. Mm. And then they're very surprised when they don't make $1 million their first month podcasting. And the truth is, all of the shows that make money in iTunes are at the top, and it's that most of them are corporate backed. There's very few indie shows like The Art of Charm that are that make money. And there's plenty of people selling products out there that say that you can make money podcasting and you can make money online and all this stuff. That's how those people make money online, you know, and so there's this kind of cycle of bullshit artistry that's also combining with bad advice or inaccurate advice that's causing a whole generation of people to think that they should just do what they like and that they're going to be successful if they do, and that's just not the case.
Jordan, how do you continue to self-develop in regards to your interviewing skills?
Well, I am constantly studying interviewers. I take notes, and I have a study block every week that where I study voiceover. I go to voiceover school occasionally to take specific classes to work on my voice. I take specific voiceover classes to work on copy and commercials so that my advertising is more beneficial to the sponsors and to the audience. And I also – VO classes being like voice acting and things like that. That includes even singing lessons. I'm not good at singing, but it's something that was required to manage and maintain my voice, my instrument, if you will. And I work on things like – I've watched 300 Larry King interviews. Yeah. I listen to clips from the Howard Stern Show. I review articles from interviewers. I hire retired presenters from Canada and the UK and the US who are sitting at home – not doing much, and I say, look, I'm going to give you $100. Listen to 2 hours of my program and give me some notes, and then I do that with them every other month, and they listen to the new stuff, take notes, and then we do a call where they break down some of my habits and tics that they think I can eliminate and work on being a better presenter. So I have constant coaching for this, and I have constant experience looking at other people who are also more experienced or doing something different and new. And I listen to other people's shows as well to find out if they're doing something that I should be doing. Now, last but not least, I always interact with my audience. So people email jordan@theartofcharm.com or they follow me on Twitter @theartofcharm, and they'll give me feedback on what they think. Their feedback is generally less valid because it can be less pointed. I should say it's just as valid. I always work for the audience. But a lot of people in the audience will go, oh, you have this verbal tic that I don't have that they're kind of imagining because they have it or somebody else has it that they know, and I remind them of that. So you have to be kind of careful to filter your feedback. But at the end of the day, you have to be getting feedback from everywhere, and you have to know which of it you can trust. And so I might take audience feedback and run it by one of my coaches. You know, do I up talk? No, you don't. Only when you're asking questions. Okay, good, because this audience member said this. So it's a constant learning process. The second you think, I'm better at this than anybody, you're screwed. And so I never try to get there. Even if your audience is telling you, you're the best interviewer ever. It's like, well, you think that, and I'm glad, but it's definitely not the case.
What's up, guys? Be sure to pick up your free copy of Conversations with Champions. This is our free ebook, which is comprised of inspirational quotes from past guests that we've had on the show.
Get inspirational quotes from champions such as Evander Holyfield, Jonathan Thurston, Grant Cardone, Gary Vee, Larry Holmes, Mario Andretti, Anthony Mundine, Joe DeFranco, and many, many more.
To pick up your free copy now, just simply go to our website, www.divisionboardpodcast.com/ebook. Put your name and email in the slot. It takes about 10 seconds, and we'll send you the book directly to your inbox. Now back to the show.
Yeah, the feedback is very important. Just this past week, you know, I was teaching a course to young coaches on the importance of taking it. We did this thing called a feedback circle. And you recently, your interview with Michelle Letterman, you were highlighting the importance of taking it and using it as a tool for growth. What do you feel why it's so hard for most people to take that feedback? Do you think it's a mindset? Do you think it's a self-proclaiming prophecy of people not wanting to grow and, you know, self-sabotaging?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of self-sabotage, but I also think people don't really want feedback most of the time. What they want is reassurance that they're doing something good, or well, I should say. Mm. So when people say, I'd love any feedback, 90% of the time what they mean is, I want you to compliment my work. Mm. And that's not that useful. And the problem is, it was really easy for me in the past, and it's really easy for a lot of people, frankly, to do the following, which is, hey, I'm looking forward to feedback. And someone's like, yeah, so I listened to it, and what I liked was this, but I think you missed a couple of really important things. And then I go, that guy's an idiot, whatever. What does he know? You know, and then it's like, hey, Jordan, this was cool, but, you know, I really thought that this off-color joke was not on brand for you. And then I go, cool, yeah, thanks, I appreciate that. And then I go, that guy's no sense of humor. What a loser, right? And so you have to be careful because your ego, my ego, will immediately jump to that. And it doesn't matter how many years I've been doing this, my first gut reaction to a lot of feedback, not most, but certainly some, is, dah, you don't know what you're talking about, dude. And the truth is, half the people really don't know what they're talking about, right? They just don't. A lot of people give you feedback that doesn't make any sense or has to do with their own insecurities. So the way that we felt to that is, if somebody says, hey, Jordan, you have a horrible verbal tick of up-talking at the end of sentences, I go, huh, okay, what episode was that? And they go, this one. And I go, great, okay. And I send it to my producer, and I send it to my assistant producer, who've already heard it, by the way, and would have told me. I send it to my wife. I send it to my friends, and I go, let me know if I have any verbal tics, especially if you hear up-talk. And I'm highlighting the thing that they are going to then look for. So if they're looking for it, they'll definitely find it if it's in there. And if that comes back as, nah, I didn't really hear anything like that, then I know that this person who gave me that feedback, their feedback is a bunch of bunk. However, if you hear something from 20 audience members, you probably have that, right? If they're not sitting there in the same room and they give you the same feedback from multiple directions, you have that. And it's very hard then to separate opinion from valid feedback, which often is an actual opinion, and then also finding something actionable at the end of it. I had recent feedback that came from a guy on Facebook, and he said, you know what, I love your show, but you brag way too much. How you want the feedback? And I wrote back and I said, hey, look, I love the feedback. Which episodes are you listening to? I have no idea of any instance that I can go back and listen to, because clearly I don't think I'm bragging all the time. So if I can't see it, I can't do anything about it. Tell me what episode this is in and where you found it. And then he wrote back and goes, oh, actually, you know what? I listened to the stuff from 3 years ago. I listened to some new stuff and you're not doing that anymore. And I was like, well, great. Okay. So you really have to pinpoint what's going on with the feedback, because often feedback is somebody's own insecurity being projected on you. Often it's not actionable because it's too vague. For example, you brag a lot. Mm. Well, okay, I have 1,000 hours of audio. You want to make that, want to narrow it down a little for me? or you get something that is just an opinion that doesn't even make any sense. Now in America, and I'm sure you guys are familiar with this, the alt-right and all these kind of weird sort of fringe groups are just going bananas. And I got feedback the other day, Jordan, you know, you're okay, but you're a cuck. You know what that word means?
Yeah, Rogan. Before? Yeah. Do you want to explain?
I don't even know if I know what it means. It's the first time I've been called that. So I was just like, I Googled it and I was like, okay, they don't mean it literally, which is like some sort of sex fetish thing.
Yeah.
They mean it to like, it's kind of just like calling you a wuss or something, right? I don't know. You want to enlighten me on that?
Yeah, it's exactly what you said. It's like the new age calling somebody like, you know, a pussy, like a dude in the dictionary. It's actually a guy who sits back and watches another guy hook up with his wife.
Oh, wow. Right, exactly. So I was like,
how logical, right?
Like, okay. Yeah, I was like, well, I don't actually watch other dudes hook up with my wife. So I was just like, what is this? And then I found that it's basically what a lot of these alt-right, pseudo-white supremacist type guys are saying about people who disagree with them.
Wow.
And so I'm like, oh, okay, so this person listened to my show and found out that I don't hate immigrants, and so now I'm a cuck, right? So, like, that's not feedback.
Yeah.
And you have to be careful with that. That's a really obvious example. I don't think anybody would go, I need to be less of a cuck next time. There's, you know, that's not a real bit of feedback. But people will often get things that are right on the borderline, like, hey, you know, you seem really fake. That's one bit of feedback that I got from somebody that I thought, okay, I want to fix that if that's the case. And I started to dig and I wanted to ask what this person's feedback was. And you have to inquire and you have to get specific. It has to be specific. It has to be actionable. And if they can show you an example of you actually doing this, then you can run that by them and you can ask very specifically what that was about. And I found out that the person who had called, ironically, the person who had the feedback that I was a little bit fake was a stripper with fake boobs, a fake tan, fake eyebrows, and a fake nose. And I thought, the irony is not lost on me here, but on the other hand, you don't just want to insult the source of the feedback. Maybe somebody with all that fake stuff knows fake when they see it. So I really wanted to drill down in there. And it kind of turned out that she just assumed my voice was fake, which I thought was really bizarre feedback. I talk like this in person. I think maybe she just thought my level of animation was fake. But the idea here is that you really do need to consider the source of feedback, but not insult the source of feedback, because that gets dangerous. Drill down to the specific. Get very timely, and if you can, get a very concrete example, something that you can literally, in my case, play back for friends. Like, it's really easy to get feedback on the show because it's a piece of recorded work. So it's not – so this person thought this about this thing that you can't see. I can literally send the exact same show or 10-minute segment of one show to 5, 10, 20 people and get feedback from all of them. And then when you want to sort of focus group it, which is what I call that – you have to do it with people that aren't going to be yes men. Yeah. So you don't send it to your mom and go, is this good? You send it to your wife and your friends and then people that you know, but maybe that aren't afraid to say, oh, man, this is not your best. This thing stunk. You know, you want to send it to those people because they will give you the truth and not just make you feel better. And that's how you get good feedback and actually work on something instead of just placating your ego, which is what most of us do when we say we want feedback.
Okay, we appreciate that advice, man. That's good. Jordan, it's story time, man. I know you've been kidnapped twice. I need to know a few little details, and I'm sure our audience will enjoy, well, not probably not enjoy, but you've been kidnapped in Serbia and Mexico, man. Tell us about that situation.
Yeah, so I'm only going to give the short version because it basically takes like an hour to tell one of those stories. But basically, when I was in Serbia, this is the second time, because the first time it was basically gypsy cab in Mexico, which is like a fake taxi. They took, you know, started to take me somewhere. The second time was when I was working in Serbia, which is not Siberia. It's part of the former Yugoslavia, Serbia. And I was working there as a teacher, and I ended up being on state security's radar for various reasons, in part because my teaching fellowship was via the Department of Defense, so they thought I was a spy, and then you're supposed to check in with the police if you don't have diplomatic cover. So I decided, screw that, I'm not checking in with the police, because one time they arrested me for being at the police station at 11:30 at night because they just assumed I was a criminal because I was sitting there waiting for their fat asses to get ready to register me. And when they arrested me, they put me in a cell with a bunch of gypsy prostitutes that were smoking unfiltered cigarettes all night and talking loudly in their dialect, and I couldn't sleep, and I'm inhaling this toxic stuff. So I decided, screw this, come find me, you suckers. And that's exactly what they did. So that was an interesting situation because I needed to develop a lot of rapport with the people who took me, and they, you know, my friend who had a big mouth wasn't doing any favors for himself, so we sort of have a direct side-by-side comparison. And it turned out that we had some mutual connections and that verified who I was, and I was able to also buy some time with them trusting me, and then I escaped. And when I escaped, I went to the regular police, who then called people that we knew mutually, and I was able to get out of there before the state security guys figured out where we'd gone. So it was a complicated situation that involved kind of an international incident. We ended up getting a letter of apology from the foreign ministry of Serbia that we weren't even allowed to keep a copy of because they didn't want to make it a thing. And so, yeah, it was on the front page of the news in the country, along with what I later found out was kind of the resulting cover-ups that countries like that do, and that we see now in countries like Russia, where they published the story and it was pretty accurate, and then a few days later they published a bunch of absolute garbage stating something like, oh, we were criminals and we were already, you know, we were massively intoxicated and we gotten violent with these guys. And I was like, holy crap, I've literally had no contact with these people, with the police, with the kidnappers, with the U.S. embassy, nothing since I left. And the story is still evolving and taking shape so that if anybody points to it later, they can go, look, they were criminals. They were doing this. They were doing that. And it was cold. It was a cold reality. And I realized, wow, you know, if you live in a country like that, you have almost no hope of justice because you have to deal with that governmental crap all the time. And so it was a really interesting reality check for somebody living in the United States, because if that had happened here, I could have made a ridiculously big deal out of it. The press would have gone absolutely apeshit over the story. And over there, the press basically just printed what the government wanted. And I thought, holy cow, that's such a dangerous precedent. And that's what we see in a lot of these Eastern European countries. And unfortunately, that's what a lot of people accuse mainstream press in the United States of doing now. And so, yeah, now we end up going down the tangent of why it's important to have a free press and a democracy. But I'll spare you, because I'm pretty sure that's not what the Vision Board podcast is all about.
We're definitely all about, seeing things and, laying out of a path of work, putting in the hard work to get to where you want to go. You mentioned earlier you weren't into vision boards. So if I were to ask you right now, what is the bigger picture for the Art of Charm? Where do you see it in? Is there an end goal? Or are you just kind of riding momentum out?
Yeah, for me, I love doing the show. I like to interview people. I like to have conversations, and I like to teach people important subjects and concepts in a way that they can understand. And so this is a great platform for me to be able to do that. I can talk with hundreds of thousands or millions of people all at one time, and I can deliver really important concepts to that same group of people all the time. And it's just been very important, because the advice that we get now is usually crap. It's usually generic advice like, do your best, be yourself, follow your passion, all of which is invalid, and or at least not actionable. And then we also see a lot of people giving advice that's biased based on an agenda. I mean, if you buy an issue of Men's Health, they're not actually telling you how to look great, get in shape, and keep your heart healthy. They're not doing that. They don't care about that. They want you to buy the issue of the magazine and then buy the next one. That is their entire agenda. So all of the advice and content in there is secondary to selling the products that the sponsors have placed in there, or selling the next issue, or even the current issue if you're thumbing through it at an airport, of that magazine. We don't have that agenda, so all we have to focus on is good content and good quality content and good quality advice. And so especially for young people and men, to be even more specific, there's almost no source of advice that's not completely inept these days. You get advice from people who've never done what you're going to do, like a career counselor whose job is a career counselor, has no idea what it's like to have a career in your actual field most of the time. You get these school counselors who tell you things like, well, you don't have the grades to make it into XYZ law school. Why don't you try this other one? Which happened to me, and they were completely wrong. And magazines like Maxim, where we learned about how to meet and woo my wife, for example, I mean, that wasn't going to work. I had to figure that stuff out on my own. And so we just have no source of mentorship. We have very, very few sources of good advice. And that's what we sought to create, because when I was looking for advice on things, we were coming up pretty dry. And even now, when you look online, even with the explosion of the internet and all this free content, very large amounts of what you are going to hear, see, watch, read are designed to sell something. And that is very much not the case with the Art of Charm. We sell products and we sell services, but the point is we're trying to get your ears and your attention. And so in order to do that, we can't just have a sales pitch on every show. It's got to be content. And that's what I enjoy, is the fact that we're able to create something amazing for people that they can get for free that doesn't have 7,000 ads in it. And most companies can't afford to do that. Magazines can't afford to do that. Television can't afford to do that. Radio can't afford to do that. Podcasting is one of the only media that's able to do that. And so that's why we chose this one. And it's also it's engaging. You listen to somebody for 30 minutes, 45 minutes, or an hour, it's better than watching a 2-minute YouTube video. There's more engagement. There's more learning. Same thing with blog posts and things like that. You can read things in a way that's concise, and I love reading, but it's never going to be a substitute for hearing people actually explain and talk about something in a way and have it be a conversation where questions can be asked and answered. So that's why this stuff is so important, and that's why I think that I still do it, is because it's giving a lot of value. I mean, we're growing a lot in terms of audience, and that wouldn't be happening if people weren't finding utility in what we discuss and teach.
Jordan, your strengths are pretty obvious with your confidence and your presentating skills. What's something that you struggle with, man?
What do I struggle with? I mean, there's a lot of things that are unrelated that I struggle with, like make sure you walk 10,000 steps a day, or, yeah, you know, work-life balance comes to mind. I don't have that. I wouldn't say I even struggle with it. I like working all the time. I don't care about not working all the time. In fact, if I could not focus on, if I didn't need relationships or friends or anything like that, if I could clone myself, I would totally do that. That, of course, the truth is I love my wife and I'm looking forward to having children and I love hanging out with my friends, but they're all kind of secondary to my obsession with the show that I'm creating here. However, I would imagine that's going to change once I have kids. I've heard that it does, like your life just takes on a new meaning and your priorities shift. I'm looking forward to that, but right now I'm pretty comfortable being a workaholic. However, that's a dangerous thing to do for most people, and I would say that there's a lot of folks that are friends with me that are close that say things like, when's the last time you took a vacation? And I say, well, a couple weeks ago I was in Taiwan. And they're like, yeah, but didn't we do a show while you were over there? Well, yeah, only one though. What did you do when you were there? I read 27 books. What? How are you relaxing? And I'm like, I don't know. I guess, you know, when I'm asleep. Yeah. So I would say that I kind of will struggle with that, / I should probably pay more attention to that. However, it's not something I've prioritized because I enjoy what I'm doing so much that I would say, yeah, I'm pretty obsessed with it, actually.
Okay, Jordan, we've reached the personality round of the interview. Johnny's got the first question.
Yeah, Jordan Harbinger, to our listeners listening at home, what advice do you have for them overcoming adversity?
Advice to overcome adversity? I mean, what do you mean by adversity? Because I guess I'm just going to have to come out and say that I'm not even sure what that
means. So having a bad day. You know, when you're having a bad day, some things that you do to help get you through it, maybe some advice to people who are thinking about quitting some passion that they're doing.
When I'm having a bad day, I definitely always search for where I'm not using or applying, I should say, adequate self-care. So if I'm in a bad mood and I don't know why, and it's not just because I'm hungry, which is often the case, usually I go, all right, well, what have I done today? Oh, yeah, I ran from this phone call. I did that. Have I showered yet? No, I haven't done that. Did I work out? No, it's been 2 days. Okay, I've got to take care of that stuff. So I'd say whenever I'm running into a roadblock or I don't feel creative or I feel agitated or something else is wrong, I can usually look at my diet and my exercise. And once I get those in order, I found that very few other problems are even that tough to solve. And I think a lot of people, they bang their heads against the wall. How do I be more productive? I need more hours in the day. Oh, I'm always so exhausted. And it's like, yeah, you're burning the candle at both ends, but you're also just not taking care of yourself at all. And I think once we can look at that and we become aware of that, we can come up with a plan to fix it. So I'd say adversity is a very general term, but for me, I find all is right with the universe if I'm taking care of my body and I'm taking care of my – via nutrition and working out, and I'm maybe taking care of my mind by not being subject to other people's agenda, worrying about what's in my inbox, taking 10,000 phone calls, that type of thing. So I realize not everybody has that luxury, but I've learned to do things a little bit slower. I used to try to get everything done. Oh, 40 phone calls in a week along with 5 shows? Yeah, let's do it. I'll just work 14 hours a day. Now I just say, look, I'm not going to be able to talk to you for 3 weeks. I know that sounds weird, but I'm not in a hurry for this, are you? And they go, no, it's just weird that you can't talk for 3 weeks. But that's just the way it's got to be. Otherwise, I'm going to have 80 phone calls and 16 hours of recording every week and work 7 days, 12 hours a day. And then I'm going to wake up on Monday and I'm going to go, who am I going to kill right now? Because I'm freaking out.
Yeah. Jordan, what are some of the things that you're doing in your training? Do you have a trainer or anything?
Yeah, I have an online trainer. In fact, his name is Matt Reynolds. And if you're – no matter where you are, if you go to ReynoldsStrength.com, it's awesome because he does online training and he is awesome. It's really potent for me because I was one of those guys that's like, look, I would love to have a trainer, but the problem is I can't just have a trainer that has a standing appointment. I travel too much, and it's not going to work. I'm not going to be able to stick to it. With the online training, it's actually StartingStrengthOnlineCoaching.com. Sorry about that. StartingStrengthOnlineCoaching.com. It's online. He sends you workouts. You send him videos of you doing the motions, things like that. And it's really, really potent because I can do it on my own schedule, yet I can get feedback on my movements, how everything is going. He can send me new workouts. He can up the weights. that stuff's been really, really, really good for me. So I highly recommend that. That's been a complete game changer, and I'm in much better shape than I ever have been in my whole life.
Interesting.
Jordan Harbinger, if three of your closest friends were sitting at a table and you weren't in the room, what sort of things would they be saying about you?
They'd probably be like, classic, Jordan's not even here. He's probably at work. but they've, you know, I don't know. It's hard to say. I would say that my friends are very aware of my obsession with the show. They tend to think that all of these little victories that we're having with Art of Charm are pretty amazing. Like, oh, they interviewed Shaq, and they're doing this, and he's speaking with this, and going there, and speaking with Richard Branson on that stage. I don't really think about that stuff. My friends tend to think about my achievements a lot more than I do, which is great. I don't celebrate very often. I just kind of move on to the next thing. I didn't go to my high school graduation. I didn't go to my college graduation. I didn't go to my law school graduation. In high school, I was traveling. In college, I was traveling. In law school, I thought I was going to be traveling, and I ended up watching from the audience and then getting on a plane. So I just don't care that much for the celebration. I'm in it for the journey. So I'm always just moving forward like that. And it's, which is kind of funny because I don't think you don't need to celebrate, but for me, I just don't care enough to even make the effort to rent the stinking gown and cap.
Okay. All right, final question, Jordan. You're going to be hosting a private dinner party. You've got 5 invites, only rules. It can be anyone dead or alive, but it can only be it can't be anyone that's either family or friends. Who are you inviting?
How many people do I get to invite?
You get to invite 5.
Sure. Probably Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, so they can duke it out about who's going to get to Mars first. I would probably have – who else do I think is just an amazing – I mean, obviously got to have Obama in there just to ask him what he thinks is even going on right now.
Yeah, and, exactly.
Dead or alive. I mean, I'm being uncreative because I'm going with alive, but I feel like there's got to be some really interesting people from back in the day that would have been really, yeah, really, really super interesting. And it's hard to select who those people might be. Maybe like the original Dale Carnegie, just to figure out what was going through his brain, because that guy was pretty damn sharp. And yeah, got to go way back too and talk to somebody like Genghis Khan, and just figure out like, what was your ambition here? You know, like what are you doing? there's a lot of options for people once you get into dead. I prefer to stick with alive, thinking one day this could actually happen.
The alt-right's going crazy right now.
For sure. I know. Good.
Yeah.
All right.
Kook Jordan is on the case.
All right, guys at home, get following Jordan, Art of Charm. You can find it on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. You can find Jordan, www.jordanharbinger.com. On Twitter and Facebook, he's at the Art of Charm. Jordan, you've been brilliant, man. Thank you so much for giving up your time. We really appreciate all the insights you've given us today, man.
You got it, guys. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Jordan. Have a good day, man.
You too.
Johnny, my man, that was Jordan Harbinger.
Yeah, the dude does not... confidence is his thing, right? What I was trying to say is he's not one for, mixing his words in terms of what he believes in.
No, I think you described that perfectly, man, because...
It's that experience, though, man.
Yeah, it just resonates off him, the actual confidence factor.
Yeah.
And, he probably wasn't always like that, so it's great to see the path that he's into now, and he shared some great knowledge in that show. I really appreciate that time I got to share with him.
Yeah, for sure, especially, the insights about interviewing people and, controlling interviews and just, be patient and things will come.
Yeah, for sure. So, guys, we've got a big week coming up. Dave Palumbo. Dave is a nutrition expert, former bodybuilder. He actually coaches Triple H and Stephanie McMahon on their nutrition. So it's going to be some great insights.
Yeah, another science-based nutritional coach, former athlete, savage, teacher, mentor, all the good things. We're excited to sit down with Dave Palumbo.
Yeah, so the Vision Board podcast will just continue to bring it. So remember, please subscribe via iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. And those 5-star reviews really help us grow. So please, if you've got a little bit of time, get iTunes and whatever they call
it. Get iTunes and get podcasts at Vision Board, baby. Let's do it.
All right, guys. We'll check you on Wednesday.
Yes, sir.
Peace. Welcome to the Vision Board podcast. Stories of success from around the world.
You guys are scratching an itch, and that's why this podcast has become popular and successful, is because you guys are scratching an itch. You're enjoying it, and you're also benefiting from the knowledge that people are dropping.
I've never met the person in my life, including my parents, that was able to outwill me about me.
whatever profession you're in, you need to keep working harder. You know, nothing comes easy these days, and you know, you'll get knocked down, but get back up, that counts, so just keep working hard at it.
You know, you guys said you do stuff, you ask things that aren't Googleable. You guys are two for two.
There's never been a time in my life where anybody ever was able to tell me who I was more than I knew who I was.
To join our vision and follow the journey, please subscribe to the Vision Board Podcast via iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher.